This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, the official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey. Conveniently located at Cordon and Lanark in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's is a family-owned and operated traditional-style deli. Take it home or eat in their full-service restaurant. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from our affiliate TSN 690 in Montreal, Amanda Stein. Amanda, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Game 5 between the Habs and the Bruins tonight in Boston as each team tries to take a 3-2 lead against the other. Got to start with, you know, going back to Game 4, the overtime loss. Do you think that there's going to be any lingering, do you think there's a lingering hangover that the Habs are going to experience entering Game 5 in the manner in which they lost Game 4?
I mean, I don't really think so. It was a bad break for Montreal. Someone, you know, telling Carey it went up and over you, he takes a look behind him, and in fact it wasn't, and Matt Fraser's there to bang it home, and that's a shot that any of us, you know, on the radio could have gotten ourselves. I really don't think that in the manner in which they lost in overtime was so devastating that it's going to be something that lingers over them. I think, in fact, it's something that is something that they can overcome quite easily by simply dropping the puck tonight.
Amanda, I know you've probably heard this a lot in the last couple of days, and I imagine you've probably asked some questions in the scrums about this. Can the Habs win this series without the Thomas Vanek, Max Pacioretty, David Desharnais line producing?
No. That's pretty much the answer there, and that's, you know, on my morning show this morning, we were talking about that as well. In order for Montreal to win this series, they need those guys to step up. And particularly, you're looking at someone like Max Pacioretty and David Desharnais, but really focusing in on Pacioretty. You know, he's a tough guy. Oh, he's actually pretty easy to understand. He's a bit of a sulker. And things, you know, he's a streaky guy, and now he's in a bad streak here. I think he's got something like one goal in 8 games in the postseason after, you know, nearly reaching the 40-goal mark in the regular season. And it just looks to me that he's got to stop feeling bad for himself. You know, he's got to get the pucks on the net, and that's what he's got to keep doing, and not looking for these fancy plays. And that's what he's been used to doing over the course of the year. He gets the fancier goals, but that's not how you score goals in the playoffs. Everybody knows that. You just get the pucks in the net, get it at the goalie's feet, get it at a defender's feet, and just get it in there. And for me, it's about Max Pacioretty. Stop sulking, is what I want to say. It's time to just, you know, put the pedal to the metal and pick up your pants and go.
We were talking, you know, earlier in the show, man, about Thomas Vanek, and, you know, obviously he's such a skilled player, and he's moved different wings and all that stuff since he came to Montreal. But if he's not scoring, he's not really giving you a lot. Whereas if you look at some of the Boston guys, you know, if they're not scoring, they're adding different elements. Do you think that's been a factor in this series?
I think less so, really. I think that maybe on what would be the Boston side. But I think for Montreal, and when it comes to Thomas Vanek, he's been sort of moved around a lot. And because of the fact that Max Pacioretty and David Desharnais haven't been scoring or haven't been contributing, that affects Thomas Vanek because he gets moved off of that line or people get moved around. And I don't think so much that we know what he's here to do, and he's here to score goals. And I don't think people are expecting, I don't want to say much more from him in that regard, but he's still there and he's still making opportunities. They're just not necessarily going in. So I don't think the criticism in this city anyways is not directed at Thomas Vanek the way maybe it would be if there wasn't a Max Pacioretty and a David Desharnais to sort of lay potential blame on.
It's always got to be somebody, but
Oh, no, I'm sure there are. Trust me, there's definitely somebody. But in terms of like what echoes the most before and after games, you don't hear his name as much. But certainly, yes, he's a guy that was brought in to contribute, especially at this time of year, and to be a difference maker, and we haven't seen that yet. But I think when it comes to the fact that there are a lot of guys, the top-tier guys, your first line in particular, that aren't contributing, you know, all the way from left to right, there's not necessarily fingers pointed solely at Thomas Vanek.
When you look at the forward group, man, a team's not necessarily broken down by forward, defense, and goalie in terms of leadership, but I'm going to ask the question anyways. Who's the leader of this team up front?
Brian Johnson has the captaincy, and he's sort of the type of guy that leads by example. He's had a very good postseason for himself. He's a hard worker. He's always there. Mm-hmm. But another guy would be Brandon Prust. He is a guy that this team follows. You know, they go as he goes, and unfortunately, mm-hmm. he's not healthy, even though they said he was a healthy scratch in the last couple games. Well, it's not. We all know he's not healthy. You can just see the way he plays in game two or game one. You know, he would go to hit a guy, but he would just barely miss them. You know, it looks like he's protecting his ribs, and we've seen through the TV show that they have here at 24 Stay Ash that he often has ice on his ribs, and he's the guy that provides a lot of leadership up front.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. We're talking with Amanda Stein from our sister station, TSN 690 in Montreal, about the Bruins-Habs series. Amanda, from the Boston point of view, some of their best players also haven't got it going. I mean, David Krejci's only got 3 points in 9 games. If you're a Boston Bruin player, you can say, you know, through 4 games, we really haven't played our best, yet we're still tied at 2 games apiece. How much of a boost do you think that is from Boston's perspective that they haven't played their best and they're right tied in this series?
I think it's a huge boost for them because they know that there's more to come and that they can deliver a lot more than they have, and the series is tied at 2. I think you hit the nail on the head there, and you're absolutely right. We haven't seen much from Milan Lucic. We haven't seen much from Jerome Iginla. We haven't seen a lot from Krejci, and these are guys who you know can step it up to another level, and that's the thing that scares me, is the fact that we haven't seen the best of Boston. Certainly they put together a really strong effort in the end. The last 12 minutes of game two, that for that come from behind victory in the afternoon game in Boston. And there they turned it up another level. But I think that they can go even beyond that. And I don't know that Montreal has faced Boston's best team quite yet. And I have a feeling that that is exactly what they're going to face tonight in game 5 in Boston.
Amanda, before the series started, it wasn't really clear if Michel Therrien was going to put in Travis Moen and Douglas Murray, and they've played pretty well. Are you surprised at how big of an impact they've had in this series?
No, and I don't know that people would agree with you on this side of the fence here in Montreal. Poor Douglas Murray gets a bad rap, mm-hmm. and no matter what, he could score the winning goal, and he would still do something wrong.
He's a human bulldozer.
Oh, he is. Well, I think they call him the fridge or something like that.
I like that. I like that.
He's built like that. Anyways, he's a big, solid guy. I'm not surprised at how they've been able to contribute, because when you look at Montreal versus Boston, you need that type of play. Certainly, Montreal will not beat Boston in the physical category, but they've got to be able to respond and let Boston know that they can't take advantage of them that way. And the interesting thing is, over the course of the 4 games, is Boston hasn't really been that intensely physical as we see maybe mm-hmm. in the regular season. And it looks, especially after the whistle, that's where Boston tends to get in the most trouble when they play Montreal, with the little cheap shots and whatnot, and particularly someone like Brad Marchand. We haven't been seeing that, mainly because they tried to do it in game one, and they saw that Montreal's power play was going to kill them. And that's, you know, good coaching strategy or good behavior on their part to make sure that in order to win these games, they know what they have to do, and that's not take those penalties, because Montreal will make them pay. But it's also good to have guys like Travis Moen and Douglas Murray who will step up to the plate when need be, because after all, this is Montreal-Boston, and there is going to be some silly stuff in between.
Not that he needed this, Amanda, but how much money has PK Subban made himself this playoff so far?
Upwards of $8 million a year.
And is that just a matter? I mean,
I wish my performances were that would be nice.
As he had a great performance last week, he went up to $8 a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Me too. Don't worry about it. I certainly think that he's going to command some big, big money somewhere, but upwards of $8 million a year and to the max that they can sign him.
And, I mean, he really has earned it. When you look at one of his best buddies in Carey Price, from your perspective, I've always been a Carey Price fan, but from your perspective, has he changed at all since the Olympic experience in terms of his demeanor or confidence level, or is it just the same and people are seeing it more now than they were before?
I think that's Carey. I think it's always been in him, and perhaps maybe because the team wasn't going so well, it was easier to be critical of certain ways he comports himself or his lack of behavior, I guess, you know, maybe being a little too cool about things. But that's Carey. He's a big game player. And certainly that experience at the Olympics and what he did there for Canada was really helpful. But this is the Carey that's always been there. And I think you have to give a lot of credit to Marc Bergevin, who brought in Stéphane Waite to work with him. I think that was really instrumental, more so than maybe the Team Canada experience, just working with Stéphane Waite and having him really helped Carey focus and brought his game to a different level.
Amanda, we've got two pretty good coaches here in this series with Claude Julien and Michel Therrien. After four games with the series tied 2-2, who do you think is winning the coaching battle, if anybody is winning the coaching battle?
I think they're pretty even, to be honest. They're really fun when it comes to game day scrums and off day scrums and chatting with them. Most of the jibes are between the two coaches and not the players, which can be a little unusual sometimes. The players won't engage in it, but I really think both have been playing very, you're coaching very smart games, really determining what the best route to go is in terms of their matchups, whether they have home ice advantage or not. You saw Michel Therrien making the decision to put Brendan Gallagher, to move Gallagher off of his line to get the matchups he wanted when they were playing at home. And then, Claude Julien doing the same thing on his home ice. It's pretty evenly matched, I would say, and they're both spectacular when it comes to jabbing each other in the media. Claude Julien, before game four, I mean, I was at morning skate. I was with the Bruins that day, and I can't even, I wish I had the line with me that he put out on, everyone was like, what is going on? And then afterwards he says, he's like, you know, I'm just trying to give you guys something to write about. I'll make my decisions when the game starts.
Amanda Stein is covering the Montreal Canadiens-Boston Bruins series. She's with our sister station, TSN 690. Game 5 goes tonight at 6 p.m. Central Time. You can hear it live on TSN 1290. John Bartlett with the call from TSN 690. Amanda, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
No problem. I appreciate it. I hope you guys are enjoying John Bartlett.
Oh, he's doing it. We were saying earlier in the show how he calls a terrific game. We were really enjoying it.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thank you, Amanda. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Amanda.
Take care.
Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
All right.
10 minutes before the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Big thank you to Amanda Stein for having just joined us. In case you missed any of that interview or the interview we conducted earlier this morning with Michael Trakos of the National Post, you can get them for download on iTunes,
okay,
on TSN1290.ca, and of course on our website, illegalcurve.com. This segment of the show is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226, or visit them online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com. Now I'm okay. I was a little bit struggling there. I went Trakos with a very accented O's for some reason there at first, and then I stumbled on the iTunes thing. But other than that, I'm really bringing my A game here tonight.
As long as you're bringing your A game.
Tonight. It's today.
Nah, it's today, tonight. It's always tonight somewhere, right?
I don't know about you guys, but I can't wait to leave the studio and go outside. It's the first.
Well, I can't wait. You can go right now.
Well, I'm going to stick around for the last hour and 10 minutes here, but I mean, I just can't wait to whip out the bathing suit and the flip-flops and hit Grand Beach. Let's do this.
Just don't ever use the words whip out ever again, please. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah, me and Joe Thornton.
That's right. Oh, you haven't scored 5 goals in your hockey career. Never mind 5 goals in a game, though. Anyways, the Blackhawks and the Wild game, they're tied at 2 games apiece. And really, I mean, I'm stunned, I got to say. I know we talked about it off the top of the show, you know, game 4 last night in Minnesota with the Wild tying up the series. I thought after those first 2 games that the Wild, you know, would have just been the sort of proverbial just happy to get to the second round team, and I thought they might win game 3, but
I think that's on the Blackhawks for letting him back in, though. I think the Blackhawks, again, I said it earlier, I don't think they've taken this team seriously enough. And I think now they're woken up, they're going to turn it on. But the top two lines for Minnesota have been good. And we talked about Nito Niederreiter earlier in the show, and he had the nice physical element, and Koivu is a guy who is not afraid to engage physically, not the most physical guy, and then Coyle, a guy who can shoot him, and that's an interesting line that they have there. You have a great skill line with Granlund, Parise, Pominville, so you have a nice, a little bit of a change. I like Niederreiter jumping up there, changing the look. And I mean, we should give credit, I don't want to talk about Matt Cook, I can't stand that guy, should give credit to Eric Halla, as a guy who is a great skater. And he was playing above where he ought to have been when Michael Granlund was hurt. But with Granlund back now, pushes him down. It's similar to Montreal. Even if Vanek doesn't perform that well, the guys who he's playing against, he's playing against the best players in the other team. So what happens is the other players in the team play against players who aren't as good. It's similar here. Granlund takes away the heat. And what happens is Halla and guys like that are able to create offense, create pressure on the forecheck and through the neutral zone because they're playing against lesser players, and he's a great skater. So that's a line. And again, this is a quick team. We know that. And even they've been getting contributions from a guy like Danny Heatley, who, you know, we'll talk about him later in the show, but a guy can hardly move out there. He's been putting points on the board. So they've been getting contributions from all over. And then, you know, you look at the back end and Jared Spurgeon. So they're getting it from everywhere. I don't trust Brizgalov in a big game, and I don't think they win the series, but they're pushing Chicago, and Chicago's got to turn it on. Because they can play, I mean, these four games is certainly not the top level of the Blackhawks. The games they won in Chicago, Ezzy, they could have played better. And the games in Minnesota, I mean, they just had, even yesterday, they're chasing it all the time. You have to turn it on. And that, the skill level is there. And Corey Crawford's got to be better, I know that. But Quenville's got to get these guys going. They got to finish this in six.
And this series, Richie, similar to how the Minnesota Wild played in the previous series against the Colorado Avalanche, has been night and day, road versus home. The Minnesota Wild have been a different team at home, and they were able to win the series, obviously with the Nino Niederreiter goal in Game 7, but they have not lost a game on the road, pardon me, at home, I should say, and they need to win a game on the road. But to me, they deserve to win that game. You cannot take anything away from the Minnesota Wild yesterday. Sure, Crawford wasn't good.
Yeah.
But they played a 60-minute complete game. They were the better team. They were also the better team in Game 3 when they won 4-0. But, you know, Richie mentioned that the Chicago Blackhawks have to be better, and you saw Joel Quenneville mixing up the lines, and you saw him break up Jonathan Toews and Kane, and you also saw them basically move Hossa and Sharp to the third line.
Shaw's a big deal.
That's what I was going to ask you.
And that's a big deal, Richie, because he scored timely goals last year for the Hawks during their cup run, but he's also a guy that, similar to a Matt Cook, can mix it up. He's a guy they'll put in front of the net. Yeah. He'll go into the corners. He's tenacious. He plays that key role, so you're right. They do miss Andrew Shaw, and he is a pest, and I like his game because you need those guys in the playoffs. Look how effective Brad Marchand is. Look how effective Brendan Gallagher is. The small guys that will go to the tough areas and hit. Last night, I think the hits were something like 15-7. To me, that was by far 15-7 for the Wild. To me, that was the worst game the Chicago Blackhawks have played, even worse than the third game 4-0 shutout. I just thought that they were somewhat lifeless, and they weren't getting in on the forecheck. They weren't dictating the pace at all. Richie talked about that.
They had 20 shots all game.
They didn't make it hard for Brizgalov, Drew. Yeah. They really didn't. And Brizgalov, the first goal was weak. And Brizgalov's let in some weak goals throughout the playoffs. Unfortunately, even though he's also got the shutout. But the Chicago Blackhawks, I think they have to go back to what was making them successful and bring and get those lines back.
I totally agree. Load them up.
Yeah, load up the lines and get back to what was really making them a dominant team. And the first two games, the Minnesota Wild were getting dominated in all three zones. And if Corey Crawford isn't playing well, that's one thing. But also, when you're not playing well defensively, we'll talk to Scott Powers about Jarmolson. I think Jarmolson has come back rather slowly.
He
took the puck into the throat. So to me, Jarmolson's a guy, you know, you talk about the pairings with Keith and Seabrook and then Jarmolson and Oduya. That Jarmolson-Oduya pair has been a staple since 2 years ago. So you're talking about a guy, Jarmolson is just as important to that decor as Keith and Seabrook, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, to a lesser degree, Richie, but he's a physical guy and allows Oduya to play his game. So
I think his
health is important, too.
The depth in the LA Anaheim series at forward is superior to the depth in the Chicago-Minnesota series in terms of effective players. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, that Cook line, again, had a good line, a good shift, and Healy's contributed all those
guys.
Well,
Chicago's still, with Hanzus and Kruger, they don't have a second-line center.
That's what I'm saying. Well, they haven't for 5 years, but I mean, they've been able to do it just based on the talent on the wings and such. But yeah, you're right, Ezzie. But you look at L.A., I mean, they're rolling out guys like Pearson and Foley, and they're more effective offensively and depth-wise. So, I mean, Kane played 24 minutes last night, guys, and Taves played 23 minutes. So they're going to keep relying on these guys. That's a testament to short series, though. You play these guys 20, 25 minutes a game, they're not going to be able to last through at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to put it away. I mean, you have Hanzus plays 12 minutes, and I realize he gets a goal on the tip in, but Hanzus cannot keep up with the pace of the Minnesota Wild. He's not a good enough skater. Hanzus was, you know, in his prime 10 years ago, guys.
Yeah.
When St. Louis and Phoenix and all that stuff.
Well, they acquired Hanzus to be the fourth line center.
Last year to win faceoffs.
Yeah, to win
faceoffs. And that's what he did last year, and he was effective. He can't be playing 15, 20 minutes a game.
No, nor can he be playing with the guys he's playing with. He just doesn't have the speed to keep up with them. I mean, he's just lagging behind. You don't have the speed. You know, maybe talk about the impact of Andrew Shaw's injury on the Blackhawks.
Well, it just pushes guys up like Kruger and Hanzus to play roles that they're not necessarily able to play. You know, I mean, it's partly what Shaw contributes, and it's a lot, and he can mix it up, and he can do a lot of things, but also it's who's elevated to the role of Shaw, and if they're capable or not capable. And that speaks to a little more depth on Minnesota's side in terms of a guy like Holla who can come up and play really well, whereas Chicago hasn't really had that contribution. So that's been an issue for sure. And Crawford needs to be better. At the end of the day,
yeah.
You're going to be a top-heavy team. I know Versteeg obviously has been the healthy scratch, and not a great skater either, so it's trouble to keep up in this series. But Crawford has to be, for sure, guys, Crawford has to be better than Brizgalov.
I wouldn't be surprised if Versteeg gets back into the lineup.
Well, I agree with you.
Even though he's been awful.
Because Chicago's got nothing out of their fourth line in this series.
Jeremy Morin was the guy that went in, but I mean, he's a guy that has had limited NHL experience. We'll ask Scott Powers about that. But
Joachim Nordstrom?
Yeah, Richie makes a good point, though, here. That leaves a gap, and that tests your depth. The NHL playoffs, Stanley Cup playoffs, are all about depth. People have to step up. This time of year, it's not like the regular season when you can blame injuries and all that. Everybody's got injuries, as we've talked about. So if you're put into a role, you better fill that role, or you're just taking up someone else's spot there, and you're not being effective. So to me, the Hawks have got to get those bottom lines going, because we know that Taves and Kane, they're going to be pumped up for this game. They've lost two in a row. They weren't happy with the way they played. So maybe a guy like Chris Versteeg, a guy that won the Cup back in 2009 with his team, maybe he'll spark the offense.
We will find out. Let's head to break when we come back. On the other side, Scott Powers from ESPNChicago.com joins us to talk more about the series. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show our good friend from ESPNChicago.com, Scott Powers. Scott, good morning. Thanks very much for doing this.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
How was your flight from Minneapolis?
It's all right. I just landed driving to the arena for some availability, so it seems like it never stops, but it's going all right.
You know, Game 5 obviously is going to come up tomorrow night between the Blackhawks and the Minnesota Wild. How surprised are you, Scott, that this series is knotted back at two games apiece after the Blackhawks' dominant performances in Games 1 and 2?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm completely surprised. You know, I thought the scores indicated some dominance, but when you look at some of the possession numbers and you know how tight those games were in the third period, I felt like the Blackhawks played really well when it came down to those, you know, closing out those games. But the first few periods of those games, I felt like it was pretty even. So I was a little shocked the Wild played as well as they did, especially last night. I mean, I think that was the Blackhawks' worst game of the playoffs where, they're lucky that game was within a goal or two. I thought the Wild really outplayed them for most of the game, especially in that second period where they outshot them 18-9 and, despite that, the Blackhawks did have their chances. You know, Sharp had a breakaway opportunity that it was a heck of a save on it. And you know, it was a one goal game for a long time. So I was you know, I thought the Wild played really well in their building, and they you know, I thought throughout the series they've done a nice job of really limiting the Blackhawks' shots. I think it's, they're averaging about 20.9 shots a net or something like that in the series. So especially the last two games, hold them to 20 yesterday and then 19 in game three. The Wild really limited what the Blackhawks have been able to do in their deep, you know, offensive zone.
Scott, we were talking about this during the previous segment right before we had you on. The Hawks really seem to be missing Andrew Shaw. How concerned is Joel Quenneville with this, and how do you think he replaces what Andrew Shaw brings?
Yeah, it's been hard. They haven't had that same net front presence. You know, I thought Bickle and Ben Smith had done an okay job with that before, but they've kind of been you know, missing action the last two games. You know, the whole team is it's a little bit different than a regular season. You obviously had Andrew Shaw, who played in that third line, but you also had Christopher Steve, who bounced from everywhere from that first to third line, and now he's been a healthy scratch. So the depth the Blackhawks have, it's not there anymore. And then, you know, Quinville's also made that fourth line, you know, diminished that. He's put Hanzius on a different line, and Kruger and Brandon Bolich barely playing. So it's just, they're not really rolling four lines, and the three lines they are rolling, I don't think they're as strong as they were before when, you know, Versteeg was, hasn't been great since he got traded from, you know, to the Blackhawks from Florida, but he's been okay. And then Shaw is a different element too. So, you know, I thought some of the top Blackhawks players were playing pretty good earlier in the series. And then, you know, the last round, but now that, you know, when you're getting minimized and, you know, shots are at a premium, that, some of that depth that, you know, not having, that's been, I think it's been being shown right now for the Blackhawks.
Scott, do you think Chris Versteeg comes back into the lineup for game five?
I don't know. You know, I don't watch him often in warm-ups, but, you know, I noticed yesterday that he really wasn't interested to be out there. It's got to be hard for him to be a veteran, and this is the first time he'd gone through this. I know that he was a healthy scratch in Florida earlier this season, and that was the first time, and then it happened in that Blues series, and you thought, you know, that was just one kind of send a message thing, but it's happened multiple times. So it's hard to say. You know, they certainly need some changes. The offense just isn't clicking, and they're not getting rolling right now. I think yesterday was the worst possession numbers of the season for Taves and, you know, Ben Smith especially, and I think Keith and some of the other guys too. So it was a bad game where, you know, the opportunities just aren't coming as they once were. And against the Blues, they had some quality chances, and I felt even, you know, they weren't getting a lot of quality chances or quantity chances against Minnesota early in the series, but at least some of them were better and tipping in some pucks and doing some things in front of the net. But I definitely need to mix things up a little bit more than they have been.
There's a lack of depth here, Scott, as you alluded to and we talked about last segment. Does that make you think that the Blackhawks are going to go back to loading up the top two lines and try and beat the Wild that way?
Yeah, I felt they did that in game three and it didn't really work. You know, that third line really wasn't much in game three. I think it was Saad and Kruger and Nordstrom. So they were, you know, that was more of the checking line and defensive line. And, you know, he had put all the big guns on those top two lines. So, you know, he alluded to that he's going to make some more changes yesterday. I don't know if he'll try going back with Bickle and Taze and Kane, trying to get, you know, Sharp and Hosa going on that second line. But I definitely expect him to make some more changes than he did in game four.
What about in terms of matchup-wise? I mean, Minnesota's got some obviously really good scores in their top six, and they had some really good performance by the Hall of Cook-Fontaine line, and then you have Brodziak. But it's not like they're the deepest team either. Is this series going to come down to the Hawks' top guns having to outscore the Wild's top guns?
Yeah, maybe. I think the Wild got some favorable matchups. I think you know, having less change helped them a little bit at home. I think Quinville certainly liked his match was better than the United Center, and they seem to, you know, contain Parisi and some of those guys, and Parisi seemed like he played better the last few games, and maybe that's something had to do with it. Yeah, but I think the Blackhawks need their top guys to be more consistent. You know, Sharp scored yesterday, but he still only has two goals in the playoffs, and Hossa has some assists, but you need him to break through, and it's really nice when Kane's scoring, you know, two or three goals a game, but then he goes missing for a few too. So, you know, if you're not getting that production from, you know, the those second tier guys, it definitely falls on the, you know, the top guys that come through.
we talked about it last segment too, Scott, in terms of the Blackhawks, obviously the goal for them is to, you know, it's Stanley Cup or bust for a team like Chicago, who's obviously won two cups in the past few years. In Minnesota, it's already probably a successful season. But when you look at it on a kind of a long-term basis, if the Hawks are going to be playing Jonathan Toews 23 minutes a night and Patrick Kane 24 minutes a night, how are they going to make a long run here if they don't finish these series off quick?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, the minutes are certainly building up, and that goes back to, you know, they were a four-line team for much of the season, and Quinville had a very reliable fourth line in Bolick and Kruger and Ben Smith, and that was a line that, you know, often played against teams' top lines. And, you know, now that he's had to mix lines up because of losing Versteeg and Andrew Shaw, that that balance isn't there, and obviously they have to go a little bit more heavy to those other lines, so... yeah, you got to imagine it takes a toll on them, and especially if they do find a way to advance, that it's gonna, you know, it's gonna be a factor somewhere down the line.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Scott Powers, who covers the Chicago Blackhawks for ESPNChicago.com.
Scott, we got to ask you about Nicklas Jarmolson. You've wrote about this for ESPN Chicago. He suffered that terrible injury, taking that puck to the throat, and he's not able to speak right now. He's been playing, I guess, two-part question. How is he doing under the circumstances with that injury, and how do you think he's playing? Is that injury maybe negatively affecting the way he's playing?
No, I don't think so. I haven't noticed him, you know, doing anything poorly or anything negatively that, you know, he wasn't doing before, so... the Blackhawks have talked about this. It does create some communication problems, but they've been able to, you know, he's been around for a long time, and the fact that him and Johnny Oduya have been together for so long, you know, they've been able to eliminate whatever problems they may have if they, you know, weren't together. So I think the communication factor hasn't been a problem. You know, Quinville said yesterday that it wasn't a long-term thing, and they expect him to be talking soon. So it'll be interesting to see when he's finally able to talk to the media, what he's able to say about his experience and how difficult for him. But, you know, having talked to Quinville and his teammates, they haven't seen too many problems.
Scott, when you look at the Hawks, we were also talking about this the last segment. When you look at the Hawks, they still don't have someone at second-line center. They've had a bunch of players play at second line center. Do you think that's going to create more problems, especially in the next round when they play the Kings and Ducks, who are extremely strong up the middle?
If they win.
Yeah, if they win.
yeah, certainly. Yeah, no, I would agree with that too. You know, I thought Ben Smith was okay there. You know, when he'd given a chance late in that St. Louis series and early in this one, and a little better option than Michael Hanzus. And Hanzus is, you know, defensively responsible, but just not able to keep the pace with when he was playing with Sharp and Sharp and Kane. So I thought Ben Smith was better there, but yeah, certainly Ben Smith's, you know, guy that's played right wing all season and has kind of had to transform into a center. So, you know, down the middle, the Blackhawks really aren't that deep. You know, the fact they traded Brandon Perry early in the season, decided not to give Teuvo Teravainen a lot of playing time when he came over, that it's still sort of the same situation where Taves and, you know, now they're bumping Kruger up to second line, third line center, but it's certainly taken away what he gave them as a fourth line center and that defense responsibility. So, I could see the factor where, you know, that's, they certainly haven't gotten what they wanted to from that second line center. And it was something that at least Hanzus was able to, you know, handle last playoffs, where he was able to hold his own, and, you know, was a guy they can rely on. And that was one of the reasons why I thought they had had the run they did, because they had someone that was decent in that spot, and it's been lacking again this season.
Goaltending, you know, Corey Crawford seems to always be a polarizing, you know, figure in the hockey world. Even, you know, you talk about Team Canada, talk about the cups, the cup they win with him, and all that stuff. Does he just simply need to be better than he's been, Scott, for this team to win?
Yeah, it's weird, because I feel like early in the playoffs there was certainly some questions about him, and he took some accountability, and then they had that 6-game winning streak, and he was a big reason for that. And you know, even though that he only faced 17 shots in game 3, I thought he was okay. I didn't feel like the goals were too soft. But yesterday, there were a couple that he probably should have got. You know, there's a bad bounce where he goes off the back of his skate. But, you know, there was the one from the left circle that he probably should have had. And, you know, the first goal was a little bit from a weird angle, too, but maybe one that he should have saw. So it's, I think some of it falls on him, too. You know, when you have two games like that back to back where your save percentage is under 900, that there's certainly some questions, and he has to be better. Where you know, I think a lot of it falls on the offense still, but, you know, he certainly has to keep them and give them a chance to win, and I don't think they had that yesterday.
I've been beating a dead horse here a bit, but you look at the Blackhawks, you know, they obviously win the Cup last time the Olympics happened. Their roster, though, in that year was considerably different than it is this year in terms of depth, Scott. They had so many players who ended up playing significant roles in other teams. Is the fact that all those guys went to the Olympics and now they're being relied on so heavily maybe a factor in terms of them being a little tired?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought that after the Olympic break, but then, you know, for them to bounce back the way they did with the six-game winning streak in the playoffs, you know, the win those four against St. Louis and the first against Minnesota, you know, I can't put my finger on whether... you know, just Lyle played really well, and, you know, I thought the Blackhawks had that streak there where they were playing really well. So I don't know if it's all adding up now, or it's maybe we're reading into it too much. You know, it's definitely two losses, and the Blackhawks have to be concerned. But I don't know if those large, you know, whether it's something big picture like that from the Olympics, because I thought, you know, Taves and Kane both probably benefited from their injuries and the fact that they, I know Taves especially said it, felt he felt refreshed when he came back, and maybe some of that did pile up from the short off season to the Olympics to, you know, a lot of games in a row before he got hurt. So, you know, I thought that was a factor early, and I thought if they got eliminated from the Blues that it all kind of would add up. But now that I think they, you know, finally went past that round, I think it's beyond that. You know, I mean, it could be more of a toll of the playoffs, and the Blues were a physical team, and maybe took something out of them. That maybe might be something.
Scott, you look at the back end. Nick Leddy was a healthy scratch for Game 3. They brought in Sheldon Brookbank. Leddy gets back into the lineup last night. Sort of two-part question. How did you think Leddy played after responding to the healthy scratch? And do you expect any more changes on the back end for the Blackhawks going forward in the series?
I thought it was okay. I mean, I didn't notice him too much for good or bad. You know, I thought Michael Roswell had a poor game last night. He had some problems with the puck, and you know, he was on the ice for a couple of goals, and he certainly turned the puck over on the first goal, and then even late, you know, picking up a penalty, the penalty turned into a power play goal. So, you know, maybe it's something that Quinville considers there. It brings Brookbank back in. Brookbank was pretty good, I thought, for Leddy, and then when he had to replace Seabrook in that first series, when Seabrook served that suspension, I thought Brookbank held his own. So maybe that's something he considers. But I feel like Leddy does bring, you know, some positives that lineup, especially, you know, his ability to, you know, maybe carry that puck in the zone and create some offense. So, you know, I think that Quinville was looking for a little bit more, just getting stronger to pucks and going after pucks a little bit more. And I think he got the response he was looking for yesterday.
Scott Powers covers the Chicago Blackhawks for ESPNChicago.com. He's a frequent guest here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Scott, thanks very much for doing this.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Take care, Scott. We'll talk soon. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
I can assure you, when I came back, everybody speculated, and I can tell you right now, you guys knew more than I did. I came back. I said at the time it was a gut feeling. I had no promises. Did I think and hope this could happen at some point? Yes, I did. I told you guys earlier, this is my dream job. In saying that, there was no assurances from anybody, and I felt like I had to come here and just do what I do. And whenever Homer decided to you know, move up or whatever happened, that I was hoping I was a guy, yeah. But I can assure you there were no assurances.
New Philadelphia Flyers general manager Ron Hextall.
Whenever Homer decided to move up.
When Homer,
oh, yeah, I'm sure he unilaterally decided to move up to be the president.
Yeah.
What does he know about being a president?
Nothing, but that's okay.
I mean, he may know something. He's running a team, don't get me wrong. But yeah. What does he know about being a president vis-a-vis what does he know about being a GM? Big difference there.
Does every NHL team now have to have a president and a general manager? Like, is that the new...
Yeah, they used to always do that. Just the president was business and the general manager was hockey. Now they have 14 different hockey decision makers.
That's right. But I think in this case, I mean, I think that's more of a ceremonial sort of thing for Paul Holmgren. I think Ron Hextall is going to... I mean, and they addressed it in the press conference. Ron Hextall is the decision maker there in Philadelphia now, appointed as the new Flyers general manager earlier this week. And the timing of it is simply because if they didn't promote him this summer, he was going to be the general manager of a different hockey team, I think.
Very possibly.
I mean, I think they... You know,
not assured, but it's very possible.
I mean, he's been talked about as a potential general manager for a number of years now.
Where was he going to go?
Well, fair enough.
Vancouver is going to be likely Benning. Gilman will get some consideration there. You might see a wild card. You don't know.
Maybe Washington is a possibility.
Washington is a possibility for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, Washington definitely is a possibility, Drew, but there's other very qualified candidates there.
Sure.
So I'm not sure he would have got a job, but they were concerned that he might have or shared the ideas that he has, whatever it may be.
I don't think they're promoting the guy at a time when he's not ready to take this next step. He certainly put in, I mean, he was with the Los Angeles Kings organization for a number of years, and he did a great job there.
Good organization to learn from.
Yeah, and you know, all due respect to the Flyers organization, if Hextall brought some of the consistency and stability that the Kings have demonstrated over the past 5, maybe even 10 years to Philadelphia, that wouldn't be such a bad thing to get new...
It definitely wasn't 10 years because the Kings missed the playoffs for 6 years in a row. It has been consistency lately with the LA Kings, but remember, they were awful for a decade.
Yeah.
And then obviously Lombardi, Hextall helped that. But you look at the Philadelphia Flyers, they have some big decisions to make, Richie. You know, we were talking about the New York Rangers-Philadelphia Flyers series from round one earlier. Both of those teams have some major issues. And the Philadelphia Flyers, you look at them and some of the guys they brought in last year with Vinny LeCavalier and Mark Streit, and there were issues. LeCavalier didn't play a lot, Richie, in the first round, and he had varying degrees of success in the regular season, but they were bouncing him around from second line to third line. I think he lacked consistency throughout the year. I think you'd agree with that, and he was given a big contract there, but they have some decisions to make on the back end. They lack speed, absolutely, and some of the players that they've counted on are getting older and aren't playing at the same level that they were before. Kimmo Timonen and Braden Coburn, two guys that have been in their top two pairs, have struggled at times, and they have decisions to make. You know that your goaltender position is relatively settled with Mason getting that contract, but they're most likely going to have to make a move or two, and I thought it was really interesting that Hextall talked about the development and draft approach, because this team, year after year, has had problems with the fact that they've traded those draft picks away, and they've got some guys in the system, but they're not a team that has a lot of upper-end talent coming through the system. You've got Scott Laughton and a few other players
they
there.
They can draft if they get the picks.
Right.
Yeah.
That's something that I think that he is going to bring in. Not that Paul Holmgren didn't see that, but I think you're going to see less of the big moves, the Richards and the Carters and all that, and the Brizgalov buyouts.
Less stupid contracts. Wouldn't be a bad thing in Philadelphia.
I think that's something. And this is a changing of the guard, absolutely. Hextall, we know, has had the experience playing with Philly and as an assistant general manager. But I think Paul Holmgren, Richie, I think you'd agree with this, has not had a lot of success in those trades that he's made.
I think the big trades he won, both of them, is he?
Couturier was a good trade, but I'm talking about the trades and how that has elevated them to the next level. They haven't got back to the Stanley Cup final since 2010, and they've been one round and out. I guess Pittsburgh, they took to the second round, or they got to the second round. But I think that the team hasn't progressed, and it's kind of flatlined.
Paul Holmgren can't handle money.
Yeah.
He's kind of like Rick Dudley a bit that way, in the sense that like he
throws it around.
Yeah, like he throws it around. I mean, Dudley's given the big contract out to like Bob Bufflin after an early start and stuff like that. Dudley's one of the best talent evaluators out there and has been for many years. But you look
still
at
with Montreal, right?
Yeah, and you look at Paul Holmgren and you think about the two deals, because I want to evaluate his tenure a little bit here.
Sure. There's a great stat I'm trying to find about like I think it's something like, I have to find the number.
$850 million or something?
Something like that.
Yeah, the long-term deals, yeah. Okay. But I want to get down to like the exact move. So you look at
Chris Gratton in there?
Yeah, you look at the Carter move.
Yeah.
And you know, whether you think, you know, you trade Carter and Richards. So there's two aspects of that. You know, you went to the finals with those guys, 6 games to a loaded Blackhawks team. If you kept the core together, would you have won? Was the parting that they alleged, you know, that was the issue, a significant factor? Those guys went on to win a cup elsewhere. So that's an aspect. But at the same time, you also open up the reins for a guy like Giroux to take over and up the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And you were able to acquire Voracek, who you signed to a $4.25 million deal, which is very reasonable for his skill level.
Mm-hmm.
You were able to acquire Sean Couturier, who is your third-line center. You were able to acquire Wayne Simmonds, who is your second-line right winger and is a power play force. And you were able to acquire Braden Schenn, who you hoped to be your second-line center but hasn't really played well enough to do that. So all those guys you acquired are cost-effective, right? I mean, Simmons is on a $3.9 million deal for long-term. That looks like a pretty solid deal right now. Those guys are all cost-effective, and they're all contributing. It's probably Shen the least of the bunch, but still contributing to an extent. And he scored yesterday for the World Championship team. So that trade, those trades in a vacuum weren't bad trades. The problem that he has is giving Andrew McDonald big-time money before really seeing what the market was for him, and that sometimes can benefit you and not. Sure. The other problem is giving Mark Streit big money for four years.
And he's 35-plus. He can't get out from under that.
Right, that's right. But just like, what does he how does he help you? He can create offense, but he can't skate well enough. Then you say, okay, I'm going to compound the problem by adding Vinny LeCavalier to a five-year deal. When you bought Aubrière, and they kind of had the same downturn in their career, and he can't skate as well anymore. So you slow down, and you give Scotty Hartnell a huge deal. He's on the books for five more years after this season at 4.75. All three of those guys have a foot speed issue. In a game that is fast, you can have a bigger team. You have to complement it well. And, you know, if you're talking about the bigger teams like Boston or Los Angeles who aren't the fastest, well, then they have Chara or Doughty, and they have Rask and Quick. And you don't have any of that here. You don't have the number one defenseman, and you don't have the goaltender. So it's a roster construction.
Well, you don't have a goaltender as good as Quick and Rask, and whether or not you think Steve Mason...
Doesn't matter. He's not in that ballpark.
He's not in that ballpark. No. And again, but compound to your point, compounding the problem, they give Steve Mason $4.1 million a year when you don't know that the market is going to bear it out that you need to give him that much money.
You know, and the Van Riemsdyk deal was not a good trade for him.
Right.
And that's the one that, you know, and there's been other moves. So overall, he had some good ones, he had some bad ones. It never just seemed like they had a plan, guys. They were always changing every 5 minutes what they were going to do. So Ron Hextall comes in, and he'll succeed by inactivity almost. He'll succeed by making less moves because there's a talent base there. I think the Philadelphia...
This isn't a rebuild situation at all.
I think the Philadelphia Flyers, if you look at their draft picks when they have them, are as good drafting, if not better, than every other team in the league, especially at the later part of the first round.
Sure.
But the problem is when you trade picks and you do all those things, if you just stay the course here... And you let some of these guys go to free agency. Now, the problem is for Hextall is he's going to have money tied up in Hartnell for 5 years, LeCavalier for 4 years. He's going to have money tied up in Luke Shen on the back end for 2 more years. It's not kill you, the 3.6. Andrew McDonald for $5 million a year for the next 6 years, 7 years?
6 years after, at least seven, at least 6 years. I mean, I think it's actually seven, yeah.
Right, so you look at it, and I think it's 6 years. So 6 years, so that another deal to, you know, hard to get out from under, and Mark Streit, and then Mason, you don't know. So you have all this money locked up in a cap system. Hextall's hands are somewhat tied.
Well, you know, to Holmgren's credit, what I thought he did okay with was, you know, he signed these ridiculous contracts, but when he deemed them to be a problem, he got out from under
them.
Yes,
but the difference is, and as I assume we'll test this as well, when you have Richards and Carter, it's a lot easier to get out from under than LeCavalier and Streit.
Right, sure. And with Prizigalov, I mean, he had to do that.
Well, it also helps to have an owner that's willing to accept a huge buyout.
You make a good point. He's willing to accept, when he's made a mistake, he was willing to say, okay, yeah. And a buyout is an expensive mistake.
Yeah, and a lot of teams' owners, you'd lose your job.
Hold on, we didn't even talk about the Brizgalov move on top of all this, in terms of what you guys mentioning the buyouts and such, but we didn't talk about it in respect to the fact that we believe that was a Snyder contract, not a Holmgren contract.
Right.
Fair point. That's right. Ilya Brizgalov, Snyder said, go get him and pay him whatever he wants.
We're going to sign him, pay him whatever he wants.
That's
funny that you do that with a guy like Brizgalov, who he was a good goalie with Phoenix and Anaheim, but I mean, it wasn't... Well, it wasn't exactly Carey Price.
Snyder's an owner who's getting older, who wants to win a cup before his time is up, and he thought that Brizgalov was the missing piece.
And he was a stats guy's dreamy because he's put up all the great numbers.
That's right. You looked at his numbers.
It's a small sample size, though. But yeah. I mean, they got out of that mess. And Richie, I think, makes a really good point when he talks about Hextall will succeed by inactivity. I think people are looking at the Flyers maybe thinking they're going to make a big move and acquire someone. I don't see that. And when you look at the team, they do have a good core. To me, the big thing, and it's kind of similar to Toronto, the Flyers have really struggled, as far as I'm concerned, as an elite team since Chris Pronger went down with the injury.
Yes.
Because as we've seen, and this has been documented, guys, all the teams that have had the upper-level success, so you're talking the Chicagos with Keith, the LAs with Doughty, you're talking the Bostons with Chara, as Richie touched on, you can't win without an elite defenseman.
Or
and I really like Braden Coburn's game and Kimo Timonen in his in his last couple of years. Those guys aren't elite, or they never were elite, but they're definitely not elite at this point in their careers.
Timonen may not come back, and it might stay.
He's a UFA after this year.
I know, but he already is a UFA. Well, he's going to be UFA in July. It might help them that he doesn't come back. Not that he is not productive, because he still can play a bit. He can still play, but not as well as he once did. But the money you have to pay him is just too much.
And that goes back to, we know who they tried to get, Shea Weber, and that didn't work out.
But, you know, the money that you're taking off the books from Timonen, you're putting almost right back on the books with the McDonald contract. So it's never, you know, Paul
McDonald's
Holmgren,
not as good as Timonen.
I know.
I like Paul McDonald, but he's a second pairing guy, even a third pairing guy on a good team, and he was just paid too much.
When he was making $550,000 on the Islanders, he was the bargain of all bargains.
Right. But the question has to be asked, was Hextall part of that decision, though?
Well, he was there as the AGM at that point in time. It's not like he just came over in the middle. You know, he's been there all season.
But you don't know who was calling what shots.
You don't know who was calling what shots. But the thing about Paul Holmgren and his tenure is he never would let a situation breathe and let it sort of play itself out.
Never.
He always wanted to be almost the first. He wanted to be proactive to his detriment at times.
Right, and sometimes that works. Like Richie said, they got to the Cup Final against Chicago in 2010. Were very close. A Patrick Kane goal away, really, from going back and winning that series, winning the cup, pardon me. But lately, they're a team that struggled. We saw how they had to fire Laviolette at the beginning of the year. They've struggled with consistency. They're kind of one of those middling teams that needs a couple pieces so that they can get back to being a contending team.
Another one, and that's a good point, Ezzy, and you mentioned Laviolette. I want to point that out as well. If you're going to hire Laviolette and play an up-tempo style with a speed offense creativity, you can't give him Nicholas Grossman and Luke Shen and those guys in the back end. You have to be able to build. Are you building around? Are you working together? Meaning, are the GM and the coach on the same page in terms of the style of play that they want to employ? Because it didn't appear that they were. Then they had to change course with Berube, who you assume, based on the way he played, which is not a good assumption to make, I don't think, is, you know, a little bit more of a defensive coach, or, you know, toughness and all that. But you can't really assume that because he was coaching to what he had. I don't think Laviolette adjusted, but that also speaks to the fact that they weren't communicating well enough.
You mentioned Peter Laviolette. He's the new head coach in Nashville. We'll talk about it on the other side of this commercial. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
The criteria that we came up with is four-pronged. One, I want to make sure that I got a good person. By that, I mean a person that would be a fit for our franchise, for the hockey ops, for myself, would be a fit for the community and Nashville. And I know 100% for sure I did that with Peter Laviolette and his wife and his three kids.
Nashville Predators general manager David Poile, upon hiring Peter Laviolette to be the second head coach in Predators franchise history. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by CompuStitch Embroidery Design, the official sponsor of the Illegal Curve Overtime Pool. CompuStitch Embroidery Design has been serving Winnipeg and surrounding areas for over 15 years. No matter the size of the job, small or large, CompuStitch Embroidery Design provides expert attention to customers' needs. For more information, visit CompuStitch.net. So, gentlemen, did David Poile make the right hire in hiring Peter Laviolette as the new head coach of the Nashville Predators?
Well, you know, Drew, I mean, did he make the right hire? I've gone back and forth. I mean, I have no issue with Peter Laviolette as the coach of this team. I just think it's an interesting choice based on how the roster is currently constructed, right? And I think it's an interesting choice in that I think Laviolette's a little bit more of a risky kind of risk taker in terms of his coaching with a very cautious general manager, David Poile. Like, you look at the back end and you see Weber, Yossi, you know, Delzato, Jones. I mean, it's a great back end for the future. And Delzato's got to get his game going, and Ryan Ellis. And everybody can move the puck. They got Barry Trotz said it last year with Huston Lawless when I was filling in. He said, you know, we got the core of the team on defense for the next 10 years. So he's got a great puck moving back end. He's got
and with Jones that could be 20 years.
Yeah, he's got the Rock and Shea Weber. He's got the young guy in Jones, and he's got Rene back when he's going to be healthy. So Laviolette's going to have a team, and if you look at who he had, the Islanders, and he had Carolina and Philadelphia. did he, I mean, I know he won the cup and Ward made that run, but did he really ever have the rock between the pipes like Pekka Rinne? Not really. Carolina didn't have the defense. Islanders and Philly, he's never had the defense, granted, when he had Pronger, maybe somewhat of a the defense, but did he ever have a defense like this one? Yeah, maybe a bit, but not maybe not in a combination of the defense and goaltending. So it's, so what I'm trying to say is he has different elements to the team that he's had before. So I guess another question is, did Laviolette coach to the players he had, or did he coach to the style he wanted to? And based on my based on what my view is that he coached the same way regardless of the team he had. This year he coached, and it was a short amount of time, but I think he coached always to create offense, to take risks, to put pressure on the other team, and to get to coach a lot by emotion, okay? And if he continues to coach that way with these forwards, I don't see them being that successful. So I wonder, what something has to change here is what I'm trying to say. Either Poyle's going to start adding offense and taking some, you know, making some changes and adding forwards, or Laviolette's going to completely transform his coaching style. And I haven't seen either of those really happen, so I'm not sure if they're going to succeed.
And Richie, you've asked that question. That's almost become like the Richie Pollock theoretical coach question, because really the reason why it's such a good question, I'm being serious, is because it's really tough to answer. And I think you're right. And I think the sign of a truly good coach is one that does adapt to the situation, to the players that he has. And, you know, Laviolette, I think there was something else going on there, because I didn't think he should have been fired that early into the season. How much you give a guy three games, and anyways, that's for another discussion here. But as far as David Poyle hiring Peter Laviolette, he even admitted that he's kind of been interviewing him the whole year, because Laviolette, as we know, was an assistant with Team USA at the Olympics, and Poyle was the executive general manager, even though he wasn't able to go to Sochi because of the eye injury, took a puck in the eye there. But Laviolette is someone who I don't think we expected him to not be a coach for very long, because he comes highly regarded. And sure, there were other coaches that were out there, Richie, but when you talk about this team, and I agree with you, the way they are constructed, they're pretty set in goal. Pekka Rinne's health, mm-hmm. you know, is very important to that. Defense, they have a good defense that can compete in the Western Conference. But when you look at the other players, the forwards, I should say, that they have, they've got a group there that leaves a lot to be desired. David Langwan is gone, and sure, they have Philip Forsberg coming up, and they have some guys that have filled in nicely, but it's a group that's going to have to win 2-1 hockey games.
Yeah.
So when David Poyle, I always find it interesting when mm-hmm. David Poyle talks about, oh, we're going to play more up-tempo, and when Alain Vigneault was hired in New York, we got to play more up-tempo. That, you know, sure, those are just words, but when you don't have the players to play that type
that's
of way,
exactly right.
I think the Nashville Predators are going to have to play a similar type of game, a hard, gritty, forechecking game. When they were in Winnipeg, we saw that. The Predators beat the Jets later on in the season, and they're a tough team to play against. I don't know if, because Laviolette's there, he's going to be able to turn, for example, Matt Cullen or, you know, a Mike Fisher into a 40-goal scorer. I just don't see that happening.
Well, that's the whole point. Can you open it up against Colorado? Open up against Chicago, even try to open up against St. Louis if you're able to do it. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a big wake-up call, I think, you know, in terms of the style of play that you might want to play versus a style of play that you can play. Like, Barry Trotz would have liked to score goals. He never had anybody who could score goals aside from the Kariya Forsberg kind of
right.
phase there that they had for
and they were there for
time.
What, 3 months?
Well, Kariya's there for longer, but
Kariya was there for a couple years, yeah.
But to that extent, they had that amount of offense, so he's able to open it up a little bit more. But you look at the squad, guys, and look at their top scorers. They don't have anybody.
Yeah, you look
Let's
at
be real here. Yeah. I mean, they don't have anybody who can score at an elite level. And in Philadelphia, he had Richards and Carter and Giroux and Voracek. I mean, and Briere when he was going before he kind of slowed down there. I mean, he's had elite-level talent for long periods of time, so it's a different roster than he's ever had. Now, he had elite-level offensive talent in Carolina, too. Stahl, and then they had what they had, Recchi and Waite. And
Brindamore.
They had all those guys there. And he didn't have a great defense. He's coached very similar teams so far, guys. So I wonder how he will fare with this team. And I don't know if anybody really knows the answer to that. Because as we know with John Tortorella last year, you can say whatever you want in an interview.
Right.
Right.
Doesn't mean you will be able to affect that plan because it might not be in you. Laviolette is a very emotional coach. His teams always seem to play really well after he called timeouts, but they didn't seem to start games very well, I thought, at least. I don't know if the stats backed it up, but I didn't. You can't always, you know, use that necessarily to say did they play well enough, because sometimes the talent level, they should be playing better than they are anyhow. But the point is, he seemed to coach on emotion a lot and coach on pressuring the other team. And this team can create pressure on the other team with their speed up front, but they can't create pressure on the other team with goals.
Right.
And I don't know if they'll be able to do that. So he's got to change, or Poyle's got to change. And I got to be honest with you, I don't see Poyle changing. So I think Laviolette's the guy who has to change here, and I'm not sure it necessarily works.
Coach the roster you've got, and whether or not it's the right roster. If it's not the right roster...
But Poyle has to change, too, in the way he's building this team. I just don't see him change. I see Laviolette changing before Poyle, but I'm not sure if Laviolette can do that successfully.
Well, I think the Laviolette hire is a good one, but I think this team is going to have all types of problems in the Central Division. They're in the best division in the league. I think they're going to have a lot of trouble scoring goals again next year, even if they make a move or two. And I know Forsberg's a guy they're counting on to develop here, but I think they're going to miss the playoffs next year. I think they're going to be at the bottom of the division, unfortunately, because they just don't have enough primary scoring, because they really have a bunch of third lines. No offense to them, but that's really what this team is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to compete, and they're going to give teams like the Jets and teams like the Wild, they're going to give them the run for their money, but I just see this team as one that's going to struggle for many years until some of these guys start developing, the younger guys, or they make a move and get someone else in there.
In Raleigh, North Carolina, the Carolina Hurricanes fire Kirk Muller as their head coach. Ron Francis is appointed new general manager there. Jim Rutherford has moved up to a president's position, or whatever his official title is.
I think it was of his own volition, I think.
You're saying that
Rutherford?
Yeah, it was of his own volition.
Like, it wasn't like Holmgren.
No, it wasn't pushed up. He said it's time for me to step back and do other things and let Ron Francis run this club.
If I recall correctly, Holmgren was actually Rutherford's GM for a period of time in Hartford, wasn't he?
Yep, I think so.
They certainly were there together, so that would make sense. Yeah. Kirk Muller out in Carolina, probably not a big shock.
He didn't make the playoffs in 3 years, and it was a tough one. I really like Kirk Muller, and of all the coaches that I had the pleasure of talking to in the post game scrums at the MTS Center, he was always
in some instances being yelled at.
Right? No, he was always one of the nicest guys. Trotz is another one of those guys. Some coaches just like to answer questions, get out of there. Ken Hitchcock, but Kirk Muller. I like Hitch, but he likes to get out of there. But Kirk Muller is one.
I don't want to be anywhere near you more than I have to be with you.
It's
anyways.
Not just me; it's all the media. But the Kirk Muller was always just a really friendly guy, would always answer a lot of questions. But ultimately, the success wasn't there.
But ultimately, he never had any players.
Oh, I don't know. He's got some players on Carolina.
I
there.
Don't think he has. You look at that team.
Stahl, Skinner.
Right, but that's top heavy.
I know it's top
Skinner
heavy.
Skinner plays half the games.
Well, I mean,
Jordan Stahl has proven to struggle in the second line center role.
Yep.
Which is determined by his GM to be the place that he was going to play. And Eric Stahl, I mean, has played well, but is he your go-to 100%, I'm going to drive us to the cup guy?
They thought he was. They're paying him like he is.
It's not Mueller's decision, though.
I know. But to say he had no players.
Did you see the defense that they had to put out there on the ice this year? I don't think he got a fair shot. I think he's a good coach. I think he'll get another opportunity.
Yep.
But I don't think you can judge him on this. I never thought he had a fair shot there.
Who's the right coach to take over in Carolina?
Well, I think it's going to be Kevin Dineen. Francis and him, the relationship with the organization.
Sure,
because
before he went to Florida, he was the head coach in Charlotte, was he not?
I believe so, but he also played for Hartford for so long.
Sure, of course.
And he's close with Francis. They play in Hartford together. Close with, I believe, Rutherford. So he was a guy who was a hotshot coach, and he played in Florida again. Didn't have much to work with.
The Panthers into the playoffs for the first time in a long time,
and he did obviously a nice job with the women in the Olympics. And I think he's a qualified coach.
Dineen and Francis are good friends, and that's been kind of the hot rumor, and I think Richie's right. I think Dineen will be the coach there. Other guys are being mentioned, Trotz, but I think I'm not saying that he's necessarily going to Florida. I think Florida really wants Barry Trotz there for the young team. But I think Richie's right. I think Dineen has been kind of the guy that they've thought of hiring, and that might be announced shortly.
Dale Talon says he wants to play up tempo, though. Will Trotz play up tempo based upon the players he has or the system that he's used to?
Well, we'll find out. A lot of coaches still to change, and things
song,
to happen on the carousel.
Sort of cut you off. This reminds me of the old Winnipeg Arena. Remember they used to play this after goals?
Yeah.
The Winnipeg Arena?
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. One final segment on the other side. It's called Rapid Fire.
You're listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One final segment on the show this Saturday morning. It's brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest-running independent comedy club in North America. For over 25 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. He sold out both shows last night. Tonight is his last night there. Moshe Kasher. 7:15 tonight and 10 p.m. tonight. He's a comedian. He's an actor. He's an author. He's was voted the best stand-up comedian in 2010. Go check him out at Rumors tonight. RumorsComedyClub.com. A hilarious guy.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire for this Saturday morning here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Ezzy was the author of these fabulous rapid-fire questions, so credit where the credit is deserved.
We haven't asked them yet.
Yeah, I know. 23-year-old Boston Bruins forward Matt Frazier scored the overtime winner on Thursday night against the Habs to tie the second-round series at 2 games apiece. It was Frazier's first career NHL playoff goal in his first career NHL playoff game. What rookie in recent NHL memory has made that big of an impact in his first take of NHL playoff action?
Well,
Was that your voice, Drew?
No, that was a little odd.
So, first off, did you know he was... Everybody's been talking about it, 'cause people like these little stories now that he was eating a burrito when he was called for... when he was called up, a Chipotle burrito.
Funny, because Remus was also eating a Chipotle burrito at the same time.
Nobody called him up.
Yeah.
That was the problem. So, he was eating a burrito. The best rookie... Who's had an effect? I mean, Ezzy, I know you pitched this one for yourself, so I'll let you go first.
Well, it has to be Torrey Krug. Torrey Krug came in last year after not playing in the regular season and was amazing. You remember how many goals he scored? I think it was 5 goals.
What about Mike Comrie in the 98 playoffs when he came in there and scored an Edmonton boy in game 3, I think it was, against Colorado?
His career peaked nice and early there.
2012, Chris Kreider came up and scored a lot of goals for the New York Rangers.
I don't want to hear about current stuff. I want to go retro.
It was recent memory.
Who was the guy on...
The question was recent memory.
John Drews, wasn't he great as a rookie in the playoffs?
That was Washington. Was he a rookie,
though? That's like 1992.
I don't remember if he was a rookie or not, but I'm going to check that.
I think he was a rookie. Didn't John Drews also play for the Jets at one point?
Yeah, I think he did.
This is where Remus has to type
I'm pretty sure John Drews did.
This is where Remus has to tell you in that little screen there that... Yep.
He confirming that he was a rookie. I think.
And he played for the Jets.
How about I get credit for a John Drews?
That's pretty good reference there, Drew.
Thank you. That's rare that I would get something like that.
There's other guys too who have had great performances as rookies. You got to get toss out some of the old names.
Ken Dryden, maybe.
But the question was
Drew,
recent.
I mean, we're not talking about your vintage.
It was recent memory, not 90s. 20 years ago.
I remember the 70s vividly.
All right, next question.
On Friday, Canada started off the 2014 World Hockey Championships with a 3-2 shootout loss to France. In the victory, former Montreal Canadiens goaltender Cristobal Huet made 34 saves, while Ottawa Senators forward Stefan DaCosta scored both regulation goals. In your opinion, what is the most embarrassing loss that Canada has ever suffered internationally?
For me, it's absolutely 2006 Switzerland. I think that loss was devastating. Canada ended up not coming in anywhere close to medaling in that tournament. To me, Martin Gerber shutout, maybe it was a shutout or it was 2-1. It was 2-0 or 2-1 back in 2006. For me, that was a terrible loss for Canada. And I think worse than the loss that they suffered in 98 in the semis versus Czech Republic. For me, it's that one in 06.
Any loss to Canada? No, I'm kidding. You know what? The France one...
World Cup 96 was pretty bad, too.
The most embarrassing loss, as you're getting me going on that one. That might be number one for me. But being up 2-1 at the end of that game, I know it was the U.S. and they were streaking, but they ought to have won that game, and they ought to have clamped it down. And the high stick, the kick in, that was a joke.
I will mention quickly that the Canada against the Czech Republic, a game you can hear live on TSN 1290 Monday afternoon starting at 12:30 as we bring you World Hockey Championship coverage from where are they? Belarus? I'm not sure. Anyways, last question here in Rapid Fire today will deal
with...
Go to number four.
Come on, Drew. It's all right.
Go to number four.
Minnesota Wild forward Danny Heatley's six-year, $45 million contract expires at the end of the season, but he has been surprisingly productive during the 2014 Stanley Cup playoffs, registering one goal and five assists in eight games. Heatley's 33 years old and has played 76 games this past regular season. Do you think there's any chance the Minnesota Wild re-sign Heatley? And if not, do you think Heatley will be signed by another team, and for how much?
That one's perfect for Richie, by the way. I wrote that one thinking that you were going to love that one.
The Wild won't sign him. He will sign somewhere for $1 million max to try and revitalize his career with somebody. I would assume he'll try and sign wherever Spezza goes, if Spezza goes somewhere. That's what I would guess.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think the Wild will bring him back, especially if, as we expect, they make a run for a guy like Thomas Vanek. I don't know if that will happen, but Heatley's done a good job this year, even though he's been a healthy scratch a bunch of times, and as Richie mentioned, he's been good in the playoffs. So I think he'll probably get one last contract for 1 or 2 years, because he can still score. He's lost a step. He's definitely lost a step.
He's lost two steps, but
I think he'll still get a contract.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Richard Pollock.
You know, I'm going to cheer Scott Oak. He's gone through some difficult times the past little while, and you saw his son on Britain's Got Talent, but who knows what's going to happen with the CBC guys, and we don't know, right? But Scott Oak, I think, does the best sideline interviews. He's a Winnipegger. He does the best sideline interviews. I think that's a hard job to do, to be able to ask questions that pique people's interest. He is great at it. He's a classy guy. He's been doing it for many years, and I think he deserves a cheer.
Ezzy.
I'm going to quickly cheer. This is hockey-related and unrelated. All moms. It's Mother's Day.
Yeah,
so I'm thinking of my mom who passed away when I was really young. I'm thinking of Maureen and Tanis and Susan, Timmy. I don't know your mom's name. But I'm thinking of this day. They deserve this day. So happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there, especially hockey moms. This is your day. Enjoy it.
Very good one there.
Very nice.
And I'll wrap up cheers and jeers. I'm going to cheer 35 years ago today, one of the most famous hockey games of all time, the Bruins and the Habs, the too many men on the ice game, the game that obviously the Habs ended up winning in overtime.
They won't talk about that tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll talk about it just a little bit tonight. 35 years ago today, that game took place. So just a cheer to an old, great hockey game, May 10th, 1979. That's it for today in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to our guests, Michael Trakos of the National Post, Amanda Stein from TSN 690 in Montreal, and Scott Powers from ESPNChicago.com. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, CompuStitch Embroidery Design, and Bernstein's Deli. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. For producers Remus and producer Tim, for Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for Blue Jays baseball, and then at 6 p.m. tonight, the Habs and the Bruins, Game 5.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.